The Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Chah. The reason I sound like him in a cave?
I don't think anybody disputes the fact that he died at around 18 and that he seemed fairly healthy overall. He had an impacted wisdom tooth. He had a very broad skull. We know his blood group. We know that he didn't die from a blow to the back of the head.
We'll be taking a trip into the Valley of the Kings as science writer Joe Marchant tells me the intriguing story of the most famous mummy in the world, that of the boy king Tutankhamun. Okay, enough of these cheesy sound effects. Also this week,
the idea that I'm trying to prove is that making law subject to evolution makes our understanding more complete, is more scientific than the alternative, which is that the laws are just eternally true, because now they can be explained in a way that makes predictions that can be checked.
Physicist Lee Smolin tells us his theory of cosmological Darwinism and the rebirth of universes through black holes. Heady stuff. Ian Sample meets him to discuss the professor's new book, Time Reborn. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. From DNA analysis to CT scans, cutting-edge processes developed by scientists are in big demand when trying to shed light on the artifacts found by archaeologists. All of that is in evidence as science writer Joe Marchant takes a look at the science and history associated with one of the A-listers of the past, Egyptian King Tutankhamun. The book's called The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy. And Joe came into The Guardian to tell me why this mummy has made such an impact. Joe, welcome to the podcast. Good to see you again. So your book's about Tutankhamun, the most famous mummy in the world. Why is this mummy so popular in culture?
I think it all stems, I mean, there are several reasons, but the main one is just the discovery of this tomb was such an amazing event at the time. This was the first ever Egyptian pharaoh who had been found in an intact tomb with all of his treasures around him. The tomb had actually been looted a couple of times very soon after he was buried, but the majority of what he was buried with was still there. And it was just incredible. Thousands of items of gold, jewelry, boxes, clothes.
The famous sarcophagus, of course.
The sarcophagus, the golden mask. I mean, it was just amazing. I mean, it was worldwide news and it just captures people's imagination.
Can you take us through the sort of moments of discovery? Well, how was it found?
So Howard Carter was an archaeologist working with the Earl of Carnarvon, who was paying for it all. And they've been searching in the Valley of the Kings. Lots of royal tombs have been found. They were all empty, had been looted in antiquity, and everybody thought that there was nothing left to find. But Howard Carter was convinced that Tutankhamun's tomb would be there, and he searched season after season after season until finally uncovered a step. And then they followed down the staircase and found a tunnel filled with stone chippings and famously kind of dug through, and he made a little hole in the door at the end, put through his candle, and saw wonderful things.
Now, it's one of those things where, the as we said, the sarcophagus and the mummy are so famous, and in the past, you know, almost a century, there's been stories and stories and stories and books and films and all sorts of things made about this mummy. It almost feels like we know everything there is to know about it. But you've taken a different track in the book into looking at what's happened to the mummy in terms of trying to identify its story and looking at the sort of various scientific technologies applied to it over the time. You know, there are lots of stories about who Tutankhamun was. You know, he was a king, obviously, but how he was killed, was he murdered, was he in battle, was he, one of my favourite ones, was he mauled by a hippo, all these things. How on earth do you start to quantify any of this stuff, given that it happened thousands of years ago, the mummy's been stored in probably not very good conditions for that time? Where do you start with that?
Well, what I wanted to do, I figured that the only way to get to the bottom of what we know about this mummy is to take a historical approach and start with the discovery of the mummy and the very first unwrapping and autopsy that was done, look at what they found, and then just follow each study that was done in turn and try and unpick what was done to the mummy and what was found. And it seemed like that was the only way to kind of cut through the hype, really, and work out sort of which findings we could trust and which we couldn't. And along the way, kind of found out all the stories of those people that studied the mummy and what they were trying to find, where they were coming from, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, the first ever autopsy was quite, I would say, a scientific procedure.
No, but for the time in which it was done,
yeah,
it was actually quite impressive. So it was 8 days, and they basically stripped the mummy through all of the bandages. They found 143 items of jewellery kind of crammed in all different layers in the bandages. But yeah, it was pretty brutal. I mean, the mummy was stuck into its solid gold coffin because all these sort of unguents, sort of pitch and that kind of thing, resins had been poured over it, and it was just stuck fast inside this coffin. And what they really wanted to do was get the coffin free and get the golden mask out. So they had to basically cut the mummy into pieces and just scrape it out, pretty much. It was in pretty bad shape when they finished with it. But they did it very carefully. They took a long time. They photographed every stage. They took records of every stage. And if you compare that to royal mummies that had been found just a few years before, some of those, they were unwrapped in 15 minutes and it was just an exploded mess on the floor afterwards, no photographs, no drawings, anything. So actually, Tutankhamun was the first one, Howard Carter and his colleague Douglas Derry. I do think they set the standard for how you should treat a mummy, even if we cringe at some of it today.
Well, a lot of the treatment earlier was quite brutal of all of those mummies and things. I mean, and what happens to the mummy then after the initial sort of treatment, the finding, where does it get stored, and then who gets to it next?
Well, for a while it was lying in a different tomb, which Howard Carter was using as a lab. I love the fact that when they were doing this excavation, which took several years in the Valley of the Kings, they had a tomb that they used as a lab, one tomb they used as a darkroom, another tomb was the luncheon tomb where they had their wine set out on the table.
With the hieroglyphs in the background just sort of sat there.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Yeah, and the all gold.
The tombs, they're all kind of sloped down going into the hillside, so they had to level it off with earth, first of all, so that the table would be flat so the wine wouldn't fall off. So, I mean, they did this in style. So the mummy was left in the lab tomb for a year or so, and then he was put back into his original tomb. So the gold coffin got taken to Cairo, but one of the outer coffins inside the stone sarcophagus, the mummy was put back into there, and that was all sealed up. And he stayed there until the 1960s. That was the next time some researchers from Liverpool went to X-ray the mummy, although it was in even worse shape when they opened the coffin. So it seems pretty certain that actually the mummy had been looted, maybe in the Second World War. At some point, someone had been in. There was a couple of items of jewellery that had been left on the mummy that were gone.
So you get to the point where these things are x-rayed, of course, and that's the first time you see inside, assuming. So what did they, what was the sort of, how did the sort of story of the king develop after that?
Well, this was where probably the most persistent myth about Tutankhamun ever originated, because they saw this patch at the back of the skull, which an anatomist, Ronald Harrison from Liverpool University, thought might be evidence of a blow to the back of the head. And the BBC made a documentary about it where Harrison is there standing next to this x-ray of the skull saying this could be what killed him. And so ever since then, everyone has thought that Tutankhamun was murdered. Actually, Harrison didn't think that. He thought that it was more likely actually to have been an aneurysm or something like that that caused a hemorrhage rather than a blow to the back of the head. And since then, other people have reanalyzed those x-rays and shown that it was just an anomaly of the way the x-ray was taken. There's no evidence of any problem with his skull whatsoever. So it was all completely based on nothing, which...
But people
all
want
the
to believe these stories, don't they?
Yeah, because but every story that comes mysterious. Out about King Tut, every study, there's another documentary and another theory about how he died. And when you actually look at it, it all sort of falls apart a bit. It's never quite as black and white as you'd think.
Take us through some of the other myths that are around this of the mummy itself. I mean, very, very famously, there is a curse around anyone who studies or goes into that tomb. Is that true?
What I love about the curse is that it's always stayed with us since the 1920s, but it changes over time. So when they first discovered the tomb, it was all about spirits from the afterlife. And I was surprised, for example, to find that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, who you'd think would be very rational and logical, like his hero.
No, he believed in fairies.
He right.
He did.
Well, he was very big into spiritualism and seances, and so he was a big proponent of the idea that evil spirits were guarding Tutankhamun and killed off the Earl of Carnarvon. So he died shortly after they found the tomb, which was what kind of kicked off this whole idea of a curse in the first place. But then by the 1970s, it wasn't so fashionable to believe in evil spirits, but it was all about alien technology and uranium lining the tomb floors and laser guns and cosmic radiation and all of these booby traps that had been set by the ancient Egyptians. So it was a bit of an improvement on spirits, but not much. And then a couple of decades later on again, it becomes more about using science and clinical trials to try and disprove the curse, or about the idea that maybe it was a fungus. So it becomes more scientific as you go, but the idea of the curse is still with us. So I quite like that.
So what, I mean, there's been more studies, of course, on this, and we've had better tools to study everything from the curse to looking inside the actual mummy itself in the past couple of decades, MRI scans, all sorts in the last few years especially. And your book starts actually with a particular set of publications in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So take us through why that sort of angle. You talk about in there the sort of genetic analyses and all sorts of things that happen, and then, well, we'll go into the problems of them slightly later, but to tell us what the cutting edge latest was at that point in 2010.
So this was a paper, it came out in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it was a combination of CT scanning and DNA analysis. And it wasn't just King Tut, it was his whole family, because we have a whole load of royal mummies from this time. So we have the whole set of them, really.
Was this an attempt by the Egyptologists there to actually start doing these lots of very latest technologies on a range of mummies and to put sort of more scientific information around the tombs and all sorts of things?
Well, what I found out when I looked into it is it's all driven by US media companies. Basically, National Geographic and Discovery want to make documentaries, so they pay for this work to be done. Millions of dollars get poured into this, providing state-of-the-art ancient DNA labs, state-of-the-art CT scanning machines, so then the Egyptians can do that work. But it's all what they're doing and the questions they're asking are all driven by the needs of the documentary. So basically the idea was to look at causes of death, specifically with the CT scanning, and family relationships, because King Tut comes from a very turbulent period of Egyptian history. His predecessor, Akhenaten, was this revolutionary who kind of threw out the traditional religion, started his own monotheistic religion, and moved the capital, built his own new capital in the desert, and Tutankhamun reversed all of those changes. But subsequent pharaohs tried to erase that entire period from history, so we know very little about exactly what went on and who was related to who. So it's very interesting to try and work to reconstruct that family tree. So that was what the DNA analysis was all about.
And so this was all published in that journal, as you mentioned. But then it didn't end there, because subsequently the lots of responses seemed to show that maybe the analysis was incorrect, the DNA technology might not have been so good. I mean, how do you extract DNA from something that old? Does it survive?
With difficulty. Well, there's a big argument about whether it survives or not. So with ancient DNA, we hear
We know that DNA can survive for thousands of years, but as long as you freeze it in tundras.
So we hear about mammoths and Neanderthals, and they've all been frozen, so that preserves the DNA, whereas Egyptian mummies are held in very hot conditions, and heat degrades the DNA. So there are some researchers who just say you can't get DNA from Egyptian mummies because either they've tried and they haven't been able to do it, or there have been some studies kind of looking at how DNA degrades. But then there are other groups who publish this DNA perfectly happily, build their careers on it and say, oh, yes, it's fine. And they would argue that there's something about the mummification process that preserves it. Either they're right, or what the skeptics would say is that ancient DNA studies are very easily contaminated by modern DNA. And if you're looking at a human subject, how do you know if the human DNA you've amplified from your sample is actually ancient DNA, or it comes from you or your colleague or somebody to have handled that mummy in the past? So there's a big argument about it. But with this JAMA paper, there was this big discovery documentary. I remember seeing it at the time, and it just looked so convincing. And they've got this whole family tree. And they concluded that Akhenaten was King Tut's father, and that Tut's parents were brother and sister, and that these two fetuses found in the tomb were his two stillborn daughters. So they had the whole picture there. But then I remember seeing in JAMA there were these five letters a few months later that just took every aspect of that study apart, like experts from all over the world just saying, well, no, this isn't right. And that was kind of what got me interested in the story in the first place, because you're sort of seeing these headlines on the one hand, and then when you look at it, you're like, oh, there's quite a lot more to this
and
story.
No one covered the latter? There's no documentaries on those things?
No.
Why do you think that is?
Is it just
more romantic to have that sort of nice story that you have in the National Geographic or wherever documentary? Then all these things are just little details that, you know, sort of distract.
Yeah, like nobody wants to watch a documentary saying, oh, well, we don't really know. I mean, when I sold this book, I wanted it to be the kind of the story behind the headlines, if you like, and just looking at, well, what's really going on and the stories of all of these people, and kind of an antidote to those big headlines that then, you know, that don't really scrape the surface. But trying to sell the book, all the publishers are like, oh, yeah, that's all very nice, but what we really want to know is who killed Tut?
Yeah. So do you think that for documentary makers, for books, for authors, all sorts of things, that the truth, the sort of the nitty-gritty scientific truth, the sort of details and the unknowns and all that, they're just not very box office, are they, for them, those people? That's why they're not so interested in that. But what do we know? I mean, what do we know about this person's life, and what's still uncertain?
Well, we know, if you're talking about what we know from The Mummy, I don't think anybody disputes the fact that he died at around 18 years of age, and that he seemed fairly healthy overall. He had an impacted wisdom tooth. He had a very broad skull, not pathological, but it was pretty weird shape. We know his blood group. We know that he didn't die from a blow to the back of the head. I suppose for me, I mean, one of the most striking things, which I hadn't heard about before I looked at this, is that Tutankhamun's mummy does not have a chest. The whole thing is missing. His heart is missing. His ribs are missing. The sternum is missing. And some people think that is damage that's been done since the mummy was discovered, or perhaps was done by the embalmers for some reason. But there is quite a persuasive analysis saying that that probably was to do with an accident that he suffered in life. So there hasn't been a big documentary about this, but what I was most persuaded by was the idea that there was some kind of big injury to his chest, because the Egyptians never mummified somebody without their heart, if they could help it. It was very important to them. And that's where this hippo idea comes from. I'm not sure about the hippo, but there has been a suggestion that is being trampled by a hippo is one way that you could get an injury like that. But the idea that there was some sort of catastrophic injury, I think, is quite persuasive. But for me, it wasn't so much about the truth about King Tut, because I don't think we'll ever really know how he died. But I was just fascinated by the things that people bring to it, the things that they were looking for, everything from people looking to prove the truth of the Bible, to proving the superiority of a particular race, or, King Tut gets entwined with kind of Middle Eastern politics and the museum exhibitions, and other people are looking for sort of power and fame or scientific glory. And so it was more to do with, why are all these people so fascinated by this one mummy? And for me, that was the story that I ended up learning something from, I think.
So he's a sort of the emblem, the face of Egyptology, isn't he, in some respects? And so people project onto him whatever they need him for, I suppose.
Yeah, well, because he's so mysterious. I mean, because this mummy is so fragile when you go and see it. It's just this little twig. And everyone is desperate for certainty. And I think because it's so hard to know anything for sure about it, because it's been manhandled by all these different groups of people, it then leaves you free to, project any particular theory that you want. So I think maybe that's why he's so attractive to people.
It's worth talking a bit about Egyptology today. I mean, we've kind of hinted at the fact that there's lots and lots of new analyses of all sorts of things going on. You know, you can use genetic and scanning technologies to really examine a lot of these archaeological places and objects. And you mentioned the media interest sort of driving a lot of that. Well, first of all, does that disturb you, that this is the way that this is going? This is a really important part of human history, being sort of examined essentially by advertisers in America.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's a shame. I mean, it comes partly from the fact that in Egypt, they're understandably very defensive about foreigners coming in and doing work on their artifacts because of their history, and so many Westerners just coming in and taking loads of stuff out. So they're really keen for it to be done by all Egyptian teams, which I completely understand. But they don't always have the money or the expertise to use some of these techniques, which then means that it has to be funded by these kind of American media organisations. So actually, ironically, it ends up kind of out of the Egyptians' hands anyway.
You'd think that the tourism they get surely would make them a fortune to actually do some of this stuff as well, or does it not?
I mean, they do get a huge amount of money from tourism, so this stuff is extremely important for Egypt, which is why through the book, like again and again, the politics and the history of what was going on in Egypt as a country kept coming into the story, because the regime and who's in power at the time really ends up shaping who gets to work on the mummy, and they're so keen for this work to be done. But no, I think I do. I mean, I do find these documentaries really dumbed down. It's not that they're wrong. It's just that they tell you a very simplified headline and you don't get any sense of the arguments and the controversies that are going on behind that and the uncertainties. And I just find all of that so much more interesting than just one dumbed down headline after another, pretending that this is the final word and that this is what everyone believes. I do think that's a bit of a shame.
And what about the recent sort of upheavals in Egypt? How has that changed the way archaeology in that country is funded, seen, used? I mean, there's been a lot of trouble. So, you know, are we looking at better analyses of these things in future, or is it all a bit uncertain?
It's thrown everything into uncertainty. All the work has stopped for the time being and nobody knows what is going on. So there's this ancient DNA lab underneath the Egyptological Museum in Cairo, and that is just empty now. The CT scanner that was donated is not being used. And Zahi Hawass, before the revolution, was sort of the head of antiquities in Egypt, and he was an incredibly charismatic guy, you know, one of those people that you love or hate, and he kind of drove a lot of this stuff and had really strong links with National Geographic, for example, and got a lot of this work done and appeared in all of these documentaries and just made it this big worldwide story. But he lost his job sort of shortly after the revolution. He was a minister in Mubarak's government, and so there was a sort of feeling that they wanted to distance themselves from people in that administration, and a succession of people have been in charge of antiquities since, but none of them really has that profile, so it's not clear kind of what work is going to be done now. But I did find it really fascinating to go to Egypt after the revolution and to meet the people who did this work and kind of find out their stories. So I met up with Yahya Gad, who did the DNA analysis, and he's just a name on a paper, you know, in the stories. You don't actually get to realise who these people are, but I met up with him and he was telling me about how he marched in the protests against Mubarak with his sons in law. He was so proud of it. He was showing photos on his mobile phone. He was telling me about his grandson who was born 2 hours after Mubarak stepped down. And it was just really nice to get that sort of personal side of it and to realise how much all of this means to them. But yeah, the downside is that we don't know when the next work is going to be done on those mummies.
But it's in flux now. But I mean, is there any sense that that they will get back to doing this sort of quite amazing work that's been happening the last 10 years to really put this onto a scientific footing? You hope?
People there hope that it might be a new beginning for Egyptology. They haven't got any money, and they've got even less money than before. When Hawass left, they suddenly realised that the antiquity service there, although they should have millions of dollars that's come in from all of these touring exhibitions of Tut's treasures, it's all been spent. They've got no money at all. They owe a lot of money. So if any work is being done, it's going to be the same pattern. It's probably going to be a media organisation comes in and funds it. It's hard to see how that'll change.
Or maybe perhaps they can make a documentary about your book. You know, that could be the thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a 15-part on all the nuances.
Yeah, why not?
Of the future of the documentary. Jo, thank you very much for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
The Shadow King, The Bizarre Afterlife of King Tut's Mummy, is published by Da Capo Press and available in all good on and offline bookstores now. To find out more about Jo's writing, go to her website, jomarchant.com.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition.
Gary Young writes that hypocrisy lies at the heart of the trial of Bradley Manning, and George Monbiot gives a very personal reaction to the murder of April Jones. Also in our audiobook review, we examine appetite with Lionel Shriver's novel Big Brother and Jay Rayner's exploration of the food industry, A Greedy Man in a Hungry World.
To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Lee Smolin is an American theoretical physicist. He's on the faculty of the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo in Canada, and he's an outspoken critic of string theory. He's very well known for ruffling the feathers of the physics community on a regular basis. His latest challenge is to make us all think differently about time. Now, physicists traditionally think that time is actually an illusion, but Smolin reckons that that idea is holding science back. He told Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample more about his ideas for the future of physics.
You make the case in your book, Time Reborn, that we have to think differently about time. How do physicists traditionally view time, and how do you want to see that recast?
Physicists view time as inessential or non-existent. They believe that what is real, what is objectively real, is the whole history of the world laid out as if it one, as if it were a piece of sculpture, and you could just stand apart from it, outside of time, and look at it and see all the. Each of our lives would be a kind of tube going through this quote space time, and the idea is that the distinction between the past, present, and future is not real. It's, as Einstein put it, a stubbornly persistent delusion.
And is this Einstein's fault that we, that physicists think this way?
It's Einstein made it harder not to think this way with relativity of space and time, which mixes them up to some extent. But this was already in the air. H.G. Wells in the 1890s, so 10 or 15 years before Einstein, wrote, I don't know if I can remember the exact quote, but that time is no different than the three dimensions of space, except that our consciousness crawls across it.
And are you then saying that this, that we really just perceive, our perception of time passing is an illusion, and that that is what needs to be changed
that's
in our thinking?
That's not what I'm saying, but that's a common view.
Yeah, and is that what you're saying needs to be changed?
Yes.
To what?
To a view in which the present moment and our experience of time and our experience of time passing and flowing moment to moment to moment is insight into the real structure of the world, that in the real world what's real is real at a moment of time only.
Does that mean you need to rewrite Einstein?
Yes, and it's been done.
And how does that change other things?
Well, it opens up the possibility that the laws of nature are not true timelessly, are not outside of time, are not once and for all either true or not true, but are the results of evolution in time, that the laws of nature can change and evolve in time. And that opens up the possibility to actually explain why we have the laws that we have.
But the laws of nature, I don't think it's too controversial for people to think of those as being perhaps not static, that they can evolve over time, be different in different places.
You say it's controversial. It's not a new idea. The American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce in 1893 made the argument that I make, and it would have saved me a lot of time in my own thinking to have known about that. You see, the question is, how do we explain what the laws of nature are, the particular choices of forces and elementary particles and their properties? And if the laws that specify these properties of the elementary particles are just forever, then they're inexplicable. If they're outside time, then they can't be explained. Whereas if they have been evolving in time, subject to some rule of evolution, some hypothesis about evolution, you can, within science, try to understand, make hypotheses about how they have evolved, come to be what they are, and test those hypotheses by further observations.
What are the kinds of things that one might look for experimentally to verify the kind of idea you're coming up with?
Well, there are different ideas that I've explored. Charles Peirce had the general idea that to be explained, laws must be the result of evolution. But then, as a scientist, my job is to invent specific hypotheses as to how they might have evolved. And I'm only interested in hypotheses that are testable, because I am a scientist. So I discuss several ideas, several hypotheses in the book. One of them is cosmological natural selection, which is the idea that I started with in the late 80s, that I wrote my first book about, Life of the Cosmos, in 1997. And in this idea, the Big Bang is actually a kind of big transition from a previous era of the universe. And the universe exists era to era, reproducing itself.
Is there any reason to think that universes are born from black holes?
There is, theoretically, and that's, black holes inside of them have a moment of time where everything just freezes. What happens is that a star which collapses to a black hole becomes denser and denser and denser and denser and passes through what we call the horizon of the black hole, which defines the black hole. It's the surface beyond which light cannot escape. But the star keeps collapsing even beyond that point, to the point that it has infinite density, and the gravitational field becomes infinitely strong, and time just stops there. That's, we call that a singularity. And the idea that time stops there is validated by a theorem of Roger Penrose, Which is very general, and so we believe that that happens very generally in black holes, if general relativity is the complete description of what's going on. But we know that general relativity is not the complete description of what's going on because there's quantum physics, and quantum physics must come in at some point. It's a universal property of everything in nature that it obeys the rules of quantum mechanics. And it can be shown in models of the collapse of black holes that when quantum mechanics is introduced, the singularity is removed, and before the star reaches infinite density, it goes through a kind of transition we call a bounce and begins to expand again. And it expands again, defining a new region of space and time, which we call a baby universe, which is actually to the future of the universe where the black hole formed.
So how does the natural selection element come in? I mean, you're talking about there a speculative idea whereby a universe might be born from a black hole. If it is, when then does natural selection come to play its part?
So the universe is being born in black holes gives a method of reproduction. To have an analogy to natural selection, you need an analogy to the genes, which is preserved generation to generation with small mutations. So I take those to be the laws themselves, or more properly, the list of numbers which specifies the properties of the elementary particles according to the laws that we understand. And I assume that those numbers are transmitted from the old universe to the baby universe with small changes. And I just make that assumption, although I could argue on the basis of some models of elementary physics that should be the case, but I just take that as an assumption. Then you have a process going on which is analogous to natural selection. And it's easy to see that if there are some choices of laws for which lots of black holes get made and other choices for which no black holes or very few black holes get made, the first kind is going to proliferate and dominate, and a typical universe will be one which makes many black holes because it's much more likely to be the descendant of a series of universes that made many black holes than it is to be the descendant of a universe that made few black holes. So we reach the conclusion that our universe, if it's typical, is tuned, has the laws of nature best tuned to do the job of making black holes.
So the assumption that you're talking about there was that a baby universe would resemble a parent universe.
Yes.
And that is you say there you have some reason to think why that would be the case?
Yes, but I don't need to. Just like Darwin didn't know anything about DNA or the microscopic structure of the coding of the information in the genes, but he still knew enough that he could make very specific hypotheses about how information was carried on, enough to make predictions. And I'm in the same situation. We're in the same situation. If we had a better understanding of the very, very small scale structure of space and time in physics, which would come from a quantum theory of gravity, we might be able to make particular hypotheses. Indeed, one can. But I don't need to do that, and I'd rather keep the idea at a level of generality where I don't need to do that, because then I'm testing the general hypothesis that we've already mentioned.
So if you're talking about a means for the birth of universes and the natural selection acting on universes that give rise to more black holes rather than fewer black holes, where is the link between the conditions that make that more likely and the conditions that are good for life?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Thank you for that question. What's needed for life? What's needed for life is that there be long-lived stars that pour a lot of hot photons into cold space and set up a situation where the surface of the Earth can be out of equilibrium. And we need carbon and oxygen to be stable elements and to be plentifully made in the stars in the history of the universe. So it turns out that carbon and oxygen play a key role in making the big stars that go through supernova explosions that lead to black hole formation. Basically, you need to cool a lot of material very cold in order so it can collapse to a star. And this is done by carbon monoxide in the galaxy, in the regions in which massive stars form in the galaxy are filled with carbon monoxide gas.
If you're taking this model as being analogous to biological evolution and reproductive success, if you look around at, say, any organism, sort of a mammal, say, there will be other reasons why it doesn't just have a zillion offspring. What is to stop a universe having far more black holes than the universes we see?
Nothing. There's just the analogy to natural selection is not complete. There's not a competition for resources. There's not different notions of species and so forth. The analogy is just a formal analogy, but that's enough to make predictions from the idea. See, the idea that I'm trying to prove by this example is that making laws subject to evolution makes our understanding more complete, is more scientific than the alternative, which is that the laws are just eternally true, because now they can be explained in a way that makes predictions that can be checked. And the fact that this theory leads to such predictions is already proof of that point. Now, in fact, that prediction and one more prediction have been upheld in the 20 years since I published them. And that's encouraging. But even if the predictions were shown false, that would just prove the larger point, which is that you're doing science because you're making hypotheses that are falsifiable, that can be thrown out because of experimental results.
You get some fairly stiff criticism from some academics on your ideas. And certainly you did with the trouble with physics. I think every string theorist probably got in touch with you personally to moan about that. But you get...
Many string theorists got in touch with me personally to say, thank you for giving a correct and realistic description of the crisis that our field is facing. A minority of string theorists who didn't read the book very well or very carefully or at all misinterpreted what it said, fell subject to rumors, and got quite incensed over a imagined version of what that book was.
There's also criticisms of your ideas in this book. Why do you think... Why do you think this happens? Is it because they're radical? Is it because of a problem, an issue in the community of sort of groupthink? Or I'm just interested in where this comes from.
I don't think there's enough of a response yet to this book. The issues within the community that I work in, the quantum gravity community, the issues are not new. The question of whether, say, as Julian Barber described in his book, The Edge of Time, the universe is really at the quantum level timeless, and time emerges as some artifact of things being large, of the universe being large. Whether that's the case or whether time in some sense has to be counted as real and fundamental, this is an ongoing debate and has been for us, and my views are known and are part of the debate. In this book, I'm putting forth an argument to a conclusion. The argument inspires hypotheses. The hypotheses are testable. I think there's not enough debate in the wider community of theoretical physicists, especially in the community of cosmologists. I like very much, I did an interview on edge.org, and I like very much the response of Sean Carroll, who's a very thoughtful cosmologist. And I may respond if I'm allowed to, but I will respond in a very respectful way and thoughtful way. That's exactly the kind of discussion I think that should be going on. Maybe you have, but I haven't seen a review except for that comment of Sean's, I should say, and some comments of Frank Close in his review in Prospect. So really only those two that clearly understand the case being made and point out possible weaknesses to it, which of course is part of science, part of how science evolves. So I would welcome more discussion, but it should be discussion that takes, if I'm allowed to say, that takes on board the actual case being made. And I think that lay people should treat it the same way. Lay people should not go away from this book and say, oh, here's a scientist who says that time is real. I've always thought that time is real, so I'm right. A layperson should go away and say, aha, there's a really interesting debate about the nature of time that's been going on for hundreds of years in the scientific community. And here I'm being exposed to the present state of that debate, to a particularly powerful, I hope they'll be impressed, argument on one side of it. And I think that they'll, but they should understand, and when I write for the public, which I do in these books, I don't want to smother them. I don't want to intimidate them. I don't want to use authority to impress them. I want to inspire them to think for themselves. You know, the rock band They Might Be Giants wrote a song about science and what science is and how it works. I don't know if you know that, or they would be known here in London. But it's the song is called Science is Real, and can I quote it? I think I can quote it from memory because our son listens to it almost every night when he's going to sleep. They say, I like the stories of angels, unicorns, and elves. I love those stories as much as anybody else. But when it comes to knowledge, real or abstract, the facts are with science. A scientific idea isn't just a hunch or a guess. It's more like a question that's been put to many tests. And when the theory converges to be consistent with the facts, the truth is with science, the proof is with science. And I think that's exactly the point. Science, when it works, this community of scientists converge to a point of view because we're driven to by the facts, by the public evidence. Then there's the area of science under development where that process is in play. And that's what my books speak about, is that area under development. And as the song says, when theory converges to be consistent with the facts, that's when science is. So the ideas that I'm putting forward here can be tested, or they can lead to hypotheses which can be tested, and let's see how things play out in time. Time will tell.
Time Reborn, From the Crisis of Physics to the Future of the Universe, is published by Alan Lane. We'll have links to all the books discussed in today's pod on our blog, of course, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.